You're listening to a Centro Church podcast.
Here is a continuation of the same. I don't know whether you've ever referred to anybody as a doubting Thomas. Maybe you've referred to yourself. You've heard the phrase, no doubt. So-and-so's a doubting Thomas. Or you've even thought to yourself, I'm a bit of a doubting Thomas. I have to be honest with you tonight and say that, sometimes even I'm riddled with doubt. You know, it doesn't escape any of us. But tonight, if you're in this room and you've ever had doubt, maybe you're here tonight and you are doubting. Maybe you're doubting God's moving in your life. Maybe you're doubting the very existence of God Himself. We're going to look tonight at the climax, many believe, of the Gospels. We've been going through a series. This is week 5 of coming out of lockdown. Obviously, the implication. But we've been looking at Jesus coming out of the grave and the interactions that He had with various people in various situations. And we're up to number 5, and it's the last one. It's with this incredibly famous interaction with His disciple, Thomas. And Thomas is considered maligned by many, you know, Thomas the man full of doubt. But Thomas is actually the highlight, the pinnacle, many believe, as I said, the climax of all of the Gospels, His interaction with Jesus. We'll come to it in just a moment and see why it is so famous. Some believe that chapter 21 of the Gospel of John is merely dealing with details and tying off loose ends. But the end of chapter 20 is the climax of all that John wrote. And you can perhaps see John on the Isle of Patmos there. In his latter years, his eyesight is failing. The years are getting past. When this happened, he was just a young guy in his late teens, early 20s. But many are imploring him, John, write it down, write it down. And he has 3.5 years of experiences and interactions with Jesus and others that he could draw from. And the whole of the Gospel of John covers about 21 days. So he picks very selectively, I suggest, 21 days to be recorded for all time in what we know as the Gospel of John. And for a very important reason, he chose the pinnacle to be where we are about to go tonight. And if you've ever had doubt, and tonight, if you don't have any doubt, if you're here full of faith and power, you might want to take some notes because you might have some doubt by Thursday, okay? Just saying. But if you're here tonight and you're currently in a season of doubt, that's great. I'm glad you're here. And if you're here tonight and you've got perhaps very little sort of structure in your life and belief about even how God interacts with you, I'm really glad you're here because this guy teaches us an awful lot about dealing with faith, with dealing with doubt, moving through to faith. So I'll read the passage, make a couple of observations, and then we'll look at what it is we can take home and how that anybody, no matter what your current mindset, can enter into this life of faith. In John chapter 20, verse 24, if you're following it along, it says this, now Thomas, also known as Didymus. Now, I would have gone by the name of Didymus if I was Thomas, but we kind of know him as Thomas. The reason I say that is because doubting Didymus sounds better than doubting Thomas. I think alliteration. But anyhow, that didn't really fly. One of the 12 was not with the disciples when Jesus came. Now, if you've been following the series, a few weeks ago, we noted how the disciples were locked in a room, and Jesus just entered into the room through the locked door. Last week we looked at the stone being was rolled away, not to let Jesus out, but to let us in. Because Jesus just walked through solid walls. Didn't need to roll the stone so that he could get out. And again, they're in a locked room. This time Thomas is with them, however, not like last time. And Jesus appears. Before, the disciples had told him many times, that Jesus had come back, and he had said, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand to his side, I will not believe. But here they are now in the room, the door's locked, and Jesus came and stood among them. And he said, peace be with you. Then he turns to Thomas, and Thomas no doubt went a little white. Probably a bead of sweat just started to form at the base of his neck, and Jesus says to Thomas, here, put your fingers in my hands. Reach your hand into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. Thomas had been around Jesus for 3.5 years. He'd heard it all. He'd heard all the teaching, probably several times. And he'd heard the stories and the ideas of turn the other cheek and live lives of humility and justice. He'd heard these really big ideas. We might call them building blocks of Western civilization. But the truth is, they don't matter a straw compared to what Jesus did. What Jesus said obviously isn't without its importance, but it pales into insignificance compared to what happened in history, the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, today, you know, there's a modern mindset around that says like, oh, can we forget about, you know, the blood of Jesus and the death and the resurrection and the worship? Those elements cause division. Let's all just hold hands. Let's sing Kumbaya. Come on, we need unity. Let's put these divisive things that may only just be kind of legend anyhow, let's put them to one side and let's look at what Jesus did. What's important is how you treat each other. What's important is the way we deal with one another. That's what's important, to which the gospel says, phooey. That's not what's important. What's important is what Jesus did. You take the resurrection out of the gospel, folks, you disembowel it, which is a really gruesome kind of imagery, isn't it, right? But that's what literally you do. You destroy it. You take away any means that it has of survival. You see, the teaching that Jesus gives us is about us. It's about how we can live better and whatever. It's all good. But the gospel is about what he has done. Teaching is about you. Gospel is about him. Now, in our kind of middle class Western civilization, the story or the message that we have to love one another and hold hands it's quite palatable. But it wasn't the message that got the gospel up and running in the first century. It wasn't the message that the apostles took to the masses in the beginning days of Christianity. Because this message, this idea that Jesus was God, found its home in the first century amongst slaves, the poor, the disenfranchised, and the outcast. And really, you know, telling them, you've got to deal with your prejudices, you know, you've got to learn to love one another. I mean, these people don't really have an option to turn the other cheek when the person looking at them is their master holding a weapon. Turning the other cheek is not really an option for them. And the message of love one another is, you know, as wonderful as it is, and particularly at our time and in our experience, to this first generation, it wasn't going to give them a new identity. It wasn't going to give them hope when they're downcast, ostracized and downtrodden by their masters. But the message of the death and resurrection of Jesus changes everything. It changed their lives. It changed their identity. The Christ can indwell you was a completely revolutionary idea to them. This is not behavior modification. This is identity transformation. And for these people, what it meant was, my past is dealt with. I have purpose in my today, and in my tomorrow, I have an assurance of a new body and a new earth and living a life with Jesus Christ hand in hand. This gave them real hope, right? This changed the way they saw themselves and they saw the world. And when John wrote his gospel, he led with the whole idea of identity, who Jesus was. He says in chapter 6 that he's without sin. He carried no sin in his life whatsoever. In chapter 12, he said, if you've seen him, you've seen the Father. In chapter 8, Jesus himself says, before Abraham was, I am. Not I was, I am. I am that I am. He takes upon himself the divine monikum, the divine name of God, the self-sufficient one without beginning and without end. I am that I am. He said in John 6, if you want to be my disciples, you've got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. People didn't like that. They started in droves leaving him at that point because it wasn't nice. It wasn't tickling to the ears. It sounded a bit repulsive. Eat my flesh, drink my blood. But when he drove, when he rode into Jerusalem on that donkey that day as a king, he was basically goading his enemies. He was saying, crucify me or crown me, but I'm nothing in between. What he'd be saying to us today is this: I'm either God, the God of the universe, or I make Adolf Hitler look rather placid. I'm nothing in between. I'm either this hideous creature or I am the God of all the universe. You've got to decide. But don't put me in this little box that says, oh, he was a good teacher and he said some good things. He's either God or indeed, if you will, a manifestation of the devil. And finally, Thomas comes to this incredible declaration that we just read, the pinnacle of John's gospel, where he says, my Lord and my God. See, that's the declaration of a Christian right there. My Lord and my God. He's not just my Savior who's going to help me out of a bad time. He's my Lord and my God. It's not some vague sense of the Lord and the God. He was very personal. He belongs to me. There's no greater expression of belief than Thomas's belief that we just read in John chapter 20. My Lord and my God. And if you think you're a Christian or you want to be a Christian, that's the declaration. That's what you have to understand. You have to be able to embrace the idea that Jesus Christ is both Lord and God. So, how do you get there? There's some interesting handles for the whole interaction that culminates in this incredible declaration of Thomas. My Lord and my God. From what we can gather, he was the first human being to ever say, my Lord and my God. He had a revelation that is the domain, is there for all of us. It wasn't just the domain of the apostles or of Thomas. It is the declaration that it's possible for every heart, for every human in this room tonight. My Lord and my God. What was there in that interaction with Jesus that ends up moving from a position of doubt to this pinnacle, this huge declaration of my Lord and my God? What an incredible journey. I'm going to give you some insight into it in just a minute. But I want to just say this before I do. Look, if you're here tonight and you're worried about money, then you need to really lean into this and get the Lord and God thing going on inside of here. If you're here tonight and you're bitter with somebody, maybe someone's come and shoved you out. You thought that was your position, and before you know it, someone came and took your position or whatever happened, and you're struggling with forgiveness. Well, you know what you need? You need a declaration. My Lord and my God. So how do we move to this revelation? How do we move to this position? Well, we can say along with Thomas or Didymus, my Lord and my God. It's a declaration of faith. It's a declaration of deliverance. It's a declaration of belief. It's the declaration of the followers of Jesus. How do we get there? Look at the process. Let me point to some things that we see through that interaction that'll give you some handles. So when you leave here tonight, you can enter into the lordship and the domain or that sense of rule under Jesus, God, our King. In verse 25, he says this. It says this, I should say. The other disciples told him. The word told there is a present continuous. It's not like they came to him once and said, hey, Thomas, Jesus has risen from the dead, you know. And then they just went about their business. It was interaction between them all of the time. So they were constantly telling Thomas that Jesus had come back from the dead. They had a running with him a week or so earlier when he came to the room. Thomas wasn't there, and Jesus came and manifested himself to them, and they hadn't stopped talking about it ever since. But Thomas hadn't listened to them. I guess that's the point. And what I would suggest to you tonight, and what would be wise for us all perhaps to employ in our life, is listening to the teaching of the apostles, right? The apostles were teaching Thomas that Jesus had risen from the dead, but Thomas wouldn't listen. And I want to encourage you tonight to take the Bible and read it. And not just, you know, whiz through it and think, what was that all about? But try to imbibe it into your life. A few weeks ago, as we were in this series, we looked at Jesus' interaction with the two boys on the road to Emmaus. And just before they realized who he was, he took the scriptures and he opened them up and he showed himself all the way through the scriptures. And what I want to encourage you to do is, when you open the Bible, find Jesus. When you open the Bible, don't just think what it says, find Christ there. Because he's there. In Genesis, he's there as the seed of the woman. In Exodus, he's the Passover lamb. In Leviticus, he's our great high priest. In Numbers, he's the pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. In Deuteronomy, he's the prophet like under Moses. In Joshua, he's the captain of our salvation. In Judges, he's our lawgiver. In Ruth, he's our kinsman redeemer. In Samuel, he's our trusted prophet. Right the way through to Revelations, where we see him as our soon coming king. Jesus Christ, from cover to cover, he's there. Can you find him?
Yeah.
Thank you. I thought it was worth a round of applause at that, Zach. He is the message of the Bible. And when you read the Bible, don't just read the words. Don't just see where it interacts with your situation. You know, that's not illegitimate. But it's not the main focus. The main focus is Jesus. He is the King of all kings. He's the prophet of all prophets, the leader of all leaders. And it's our job to find him there. And even as you read the New Testament, it's all about Jesus. Find him there. Look at the teachings. You know, I love it when people come to me and we're talking, whatever, and I hear this. I listen for this. Oh, this does my heart good. When I hear people say things like, oh, in the soap this week, oh, you've been reading the Bible. That's magnificent. Not only were you reading it, you remembered it. Wow, that's amazing. And we do this thing, so in a scriptural observation, application, prayer. I hope you all do it every day. And if you've got the Bible app, you know, get in there. You can follow me on there, and you can put your stuff there. I can put my stuff there. And every day you're reading the Bible. Every day you're finding Jesus in the Bible. Listen to the teaching of the apostles about Jesus. Number one. Number two, I see here, part of this interaction with Thomas. And Jesus appears. I just read it, you heard me. He says, peace. He's speaking to everyone, peace be with you. And then he turns to Thomas. He looks Thomas in the eyes. And he says this. He says, oh, there's the holes. Touch them. Here's where the spear went in. Want to put your hand there, Thomas? This is what I want you to do. I want you to see how patient God is with you. How did Jesus know that's what Thomas wanted? Thomas said that to the disciples. Jesus wasn't there, apparently. Jesus wasn't in the presence of the followers of Christ at that time, apparently. But he heard and he knew. And he didn't condemn Thomas. He was incredibly patient with Thomas. And I want to encourage you tonight. Think of the times in your life, if you're here and you're a follower of Jesus, think of the times when God's been patient with you. When he should have, you know, written you off, when he should have turned his back on you, when he should have punished you, but he didn't. He gave you another chance, and another chance, and another chance. He loves you. He knows everything about us. He knows everything that crosses your mind, and he still loves you. He knows everything that's in your heart, and he's still patient with you. Isn't that remarkable? Friends and I watched a movie a couple of weeks ago called The Fisher King, starring Robin Williams. And Robin Williams plays this character, this kind of tragic character who's this street kind of guy, and he watches this girl. He gets in this thing for this young woman who's incredibly uncoordinated and sort of klutzy and has no social skills. And he watches her for months, and finally, through a whole bunch of circumstances, he gets a date with her, and they go out on a date. And it turns out that they're kind of made for each other, because he's just as antisocial and klutzy and sort of uncoordinated as the girl is. And they have this date, and it all goes pretty well. Anyway, they go home, you know, he walks her home, and she says, "Well, that's it, you know, I've had a lovely night with you, thanks very much, I never want to see you again." And he says, "What? I thought we seemed to have something going. I really enjoyed myself. Why, you won't ever want to see me again? What's with that?" And she said, well, because if you see me again, you'll get to know what I'm really like. And once you know what I'm really like, you won't like me. Because whenever anybody in my past has got to know me, they've written me off. And they don't like me. So why don't we just chalk this night up to a win and just move on? And I'll never see you again. To which William's character responds and says, "Oh, you don't understand. I've been watching you for months." "Have you?" "Yeah. I know everything about you. And I still love you." And if Robin Williams' character can do it for that girl, think how much more Jesus watches you, knows everything that passes through your mind, everything that passes through your heart, and still is patient and loving and kind and desiring of you. And my simple point is, I think Thomas, right then, when Jesus looked at him and said, "Here," something went, "Oh my gosh, he loves me. He's listening to my heart cries." And Thomas saw how patient Jesus was with him. The next thing which I suggest happens as we just unpack this interaction between Jesus and Thomas is he looks at his wounds. This is important because listening to the teaching and reading the Bible, it's not enough. Thomas looks at his wounds. And I wonder tonight if you can see in your own heart, in your mind's eye, the wounded God. And the reason I say that is this. I know something about you. Right? Yes, I've been watching you. And there's something about you I know, and it's this. You don't like to do as you're told because you're rebellious. The reason I know that about you is because I'm the same. And don't put your hands up, but how many of you have ever thought you're going to do something and then were told to do it and thought, "I'm not doing it now"? Maybe you were a kid or something and your mother said, "Tidy your room," and you're thinking to yourself, "I should make my bed," but now I've been told, "I'm not going to do it now." There's something about us, isn't there? We don't like being told what to do now, do we? And it was in Thomas's heart. And the reason I know it's in Thomas's heart, because I know it's in your heart. The reason I know it's in your heart is because I know it's in my heart. It's just part of the human condition. I'm happy to do it if it's my idea, but don't you tell me what to do. But there's something about this, isn't there? There's something about looking at a wounded God that melts your heart. Not just teaching. You know, God sent prophets before Jesus, great prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, amongst many others, who are incredible orators and articulators of the Word of God. And what did we do to them in the end? Pretty much, we wiped them out. And then, of course, the teacher of all teachers turned up himself, Jesus, the Son of God. And he was the greatest teacher, I think, that's ever walked the earth. So much so that even some of the things that he said have found their way into the modern vernacular. You know, people today, you're talking about good Samaritans. People know what you're talking about. Yet most people don't have a clue what a Samaritan is and where they came from. But they know the term good Samaritan. Why? Because Jesus talked about it. They know the prodigal son. Where did that come from? That come from the greatest teacher that's ever walked the earth. The 2,000 years later, in an anti-God culture, We still have his phrases as part of our vernacular. It's incredible. What an amazing teacher. I don't think anybody will remember a word I have said past Tuesday, leave alone 2,000 years later. And yet, it doesn't matter what he said, because we don't like to be told what to do. Don't tell me what to do. But there's something about a wounded God, isn't there? There's something about a God with nail scars. There's something about a God who was crucified. There's something about a God who paid a price that melts your heart. And you think to yourself, how could I? I'm so full of my own self-importance. I'm not going to believe. I believe nothing. Scripture and verse. Give me scripture and verse, you know. Thomas was the father of the fundamentalists, but anyhow, that's another story. There's something about a wounded God that melts your heart. Can I suggest to you, in all the desiring that you have, and you are a conglomerate, folks, of myriads of desires. You want this and you want that, and you want this and you want that, and you want this and you want that. It's the human condition. And all the wanting that goes on inside of us, you know, the wanting of success, say, I want to be successful. I actually think that that's a desire for Jesus. I actually think everybody wants romance. You know, everybody's got seeking some kind of relationship with some, you know, somebody they can have a romantic interlude with. I actually think the desire for romance is in reality a desire for Jesus. I'll even go as far to say this. The love of art and the pursuit of music and fine things that stimulate you are in reality a pursuit of Jesus. That in all of your wanting, and then of course in this culture, all of our getting that never really satisfies it, just leaves us with more wants, is in reality a wanting of Christ. Thomas' fears were melted. Thomas's doubts were melted as he looked at his wounds and he saw what he's done. Can you surrender to the wounds of God? Could you have an image tonight of a God who came as man and who was wounded for your transgressions and bruised for your iniquities? Thomas saw that. And the next thing, this is the last one. The next thing I want to pull out of that interlude, out of that interaction between Thomas and Jesus, which is so, so important. I said a minute ago, you probably forget everything I say by Tuesday. Try to remember this, because this is profoundly important. When Thomas looks at Jesus and sees the nail-scarred hands, so forth, the next minute, and you can read it when you go home, the next minute, the profound declaration, my Lord, my God. Do you know Thomas never touched him? You read the narrative for yourself. Thomas wants to touch him, but when he sees him and he experiences his patience, his love, Thomas has no other option. He doesn't go and touch him. He says, my Lord, my God. Why is that so important? This is profoundly important, and I'll tell you what it means for you. It means you have to drop your conditions. Have you ever put a condition on God? Have you ever said, God, if you do this for me, I'll do that for you. God, if I can touch, then I'll believe, right? And it could be so many different things. God, if you give us a child, then I'll serve you. God, if you can give me someone to marry, then I'll serve you. God, if you can do this for me, then I'll do that for you. And it's somewhat human to do this kind of condition thing with God. God, if you get me out of this situation, right, I'll never sin again. I'll never do bad again. God, if you do this for me, I'll do that for you. Let me tell you why this is so profoundly important. Because of this. Whatever your X is, God, if you do X, whatever the X is, X equals God. That's your God. Not God. That's your God. God, if you give me a child, I'll serve you. The child's God. God, if you give me a spouse, I'll serve you. The spouse is God. God, if you give me the job, then I'll... The job is God. Whatever is X is God. And I'll tell you why that's incredibly dangerous. Because that God is never going to die for you. In fact, that God is going to require you to die for it. Thomas drops his conditions. And I want to encourage you tonight, don't put conditions on God. You put conditions on God, the condition is God. And that condition will one day exact something from you which is more than you have to give. That condition will inevitably own you. And that condition has no intention of dying for you. Not like Jesus. My Lord and my God who died for me. What a declaration from the so-called doubting Thomas. I wonder tonight if you can move through this experience with me into that declaration. Why don't we stand together? If the team want to join me on the platform, that'd be great. We're going to sing a song in just a moment. Not going to keep you much longer, but I do want us to do something tonight. I want us to enter into this. Just close your eyes. And maybe just start to verbalize, my Lord and my God, there is no higher declaration you can ever make than what Thomas made this fateful moment. My Lord and my God. I want you tonight, if you can, to just think about how patient he's been with you over the years. Think of the times when you went your own way. You knew better, but you did it anyhow. And maybe you've lost friends. Maybe there are people who chose not to walk with you because of certain things that were going on in your life. But you wanted it. You took that way anyhow. But God never left. God heard every word. God knew every thought. And God still extends his hands to you in love. What a patient God we have. Experience his patience. How patient God. Can you see the wounded God? God who's not there with a finger pointed ready to give you a lecture. A God who's not there condemning and advising, taking your place as a sacrifice. Out of love for you, he reached out to you. Not in anger, not in fear, not in retribution. He reached out to you in love. Can you see that? Can you see in your mind's eye tonight the wounded Jesus who was wounded for your transgressions? He's not just the Lord and the God. He's your Lord and he's your God. I wonder if you're here tonight and you have some conditions. What if you thought, you know, once I get the house paid off, or once I get married, or once I get that point of my life, then I'll be able to serve God, then I'll be able to really call him my Lord and my God. But you got conditions, right? Maybe tonight you can just let those conditions drop for a moment and join with me and join with Thomas, who 2,000 years ago declared this, and join with many, many others in this room. You have taken the condition, said, Lord, if you heal me, then I'll serve you. Or Lord, if you take that disease away from my child or my mother or from whoever, then I'll know you're real. He said, you know, All I need is you. You are my desire. And you are my focus. Thank you for your heart for me and your sacrifice for me. And I respond to that with these four words, my Lord, my God. Why don't we declare it together tonight as we sing?
Thank you for listening to this podcast.